Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Nils Michael Langenborg and I'm a member of the club's Environment and Natural Resources Forum and your chair for this evening's program. We also welcome our listeners on the radio and we invite our audience to visit us on the web at commonwealthclub.org. And now for tonight's program, The Plundered Planet. Why we must and how we can manage nature for global prosperity. Presented by Paul Collier. Paul Collier is professor of economics and director of the Center for the Study of African Economies at Oxford University and a former director of development research at the World Bank. In 2007, Mr. Collier's award-winning book, The Bottom Billion, was greeted as groundbreaking and has been compared to Jeffrey Sachs' The End of Poverty as one of the more influential books that explore the pros and cons of economic aid given to developing countries. The Economist wrote that it was set to become a classic, while the Financial Times praised it as rich in both analysis and recommendations. Now in his newest book, The Plundered Planet, Professor Collier tackles the global mismanagement of nature with the same inquisitive mind. The Plundered Planet charts a course that runs somewhere between the polarized views of unchecked profiteers versus those of environmental romantics, to offer a set of realistic and sustainable solutions that are empowered by an informed citizenry. Sir Nicholas Stern, author of the Stern Review on the Economics of Climate Change, the largest and most widely known report on climate change, simply said of The Plundered Planet, "Read this book." And George Soros said, "This book will be of great interest to all of those who are concerned about the future of our civilization." I can say personally that I've read the book, and despite its rather disheartening title, you might consider calling it also The Prosperous Planet, The Plundered Planet offers an important way forward so that we can avoid the continued mismanagement of nature that threatens our very humanity. Now, please join me in welcoming to the Commonwealth Club of California, Professor Paul Collier.
Well, thanks very much for inviting me. The Plundered Planet is about nature. It's about how nature can be harnessed for prosperity and how, if we're not careful, instead of being harnessed, it will be plundered. And what I'm trying to do is end the cat and dog fight that's been going on for a long time between environmentalists on the one hand and economists on the other. Whilst we fight and are at loggerheads, we're actually both losing a common battle. Whilst we disagree, nature is being plundered. And so I'm trying to build common ground, a wide common ground between pragmatic environmentalists and economists who recognize the insights that environmentalism brings. The natural assets have no natural owners. That's one of the key insights of environmentalism, is that natural assets are special. They're not the same as man-made assets. Man-made assets, the rights to ownership are kind of defined by the act of creation, but natural assets are just there. And so we don't own them in the same way that we own created assets. So environmentalists are right to think that nature's special, but what some environmentalists then miss is that nature is basically important because it's valuable. Some environmentalists, I think, see nature as important because it's sort of pure. There's a sort of romanticism about nature. Whereas what's really important is that nature's really valuable. Nowhere is it more valuable than in the poorest countries. For them, natural assets are potentially their lifeline out of poverty to prosperity. So let's think for a moment. What is the ethical obligation towards nature. I think the romantic wing of environmentalism has it wrong. The romantic wing of environmentalism sees our obligations towards nature as being preservation, that we've actually literally got to hand on to the future the artifacts of nature, that all we are is a set of curators of nature. And I think that's wrong, that our obligation, we do have obligations to the future, but they're not the obligations of a curator in a museum. Nature is a set of valuable assets, and sometimes it makes sense to use those assets up. But then our obligation to the future is to convert those assets into other assets that are more valuable and pass on at least equivalent value. And so our obligation to the future is really to pass on value, not necessarily literally to preserve the artifacts of nature. In other words, we are custodians of value rather than curators of artifacts. That's particularly important for poor societies. Their obligation isn't always just to keep things, keep nature as it is. Nature's virtually the only asset they've got. Sometimes it's a very valuable asset. And so if by converting those valuable but unproductive assets into schools and factories and ports, all the things that build prosperity, so that they leave that prosperity for the future, then that, I think, is ethically right. In fact, the ethical test that we should perform is to put ourselves in the position of the future, think of ourselves as a future citizen, and say, what would that future citizen want? Would they think that their rights are being infringed if we use these natural assets up? Or would they say, no, that's okay by us? Now, it varies asset by asset what that answer is going to be. That's why we have to be pragmatists and actually look at the evidence situation by situation. The reason why we should be concerned about climate change, and carbon is a natural liability, just like other things are natural assets. The analysis is the same, except that it's a liability and not an asset. So why should we be actually very careful of irresponsibly accumulating natural liabilities to the future? The reason is that when we do that little test of what will the future think, the future is likely going to be very much richer than the present. And if it's very much richer, those future people will value natural assets much more than we do. So if we try and say to the future, well, we'll burn up the nature, we'll emit a lot of carbon, but don't worry, we'll compensate you by giving you a lot of man-made assets. The future's going to say to us, we've got a lot of man-made assets anyway. If you're going to destroy our climate, then in order to compensate us, you'll need to leave us an awful lot of man-made assets. And so in that case, the sensible thing to do is actually to preserve nature, not to use it up and compensate the future with something else. So a poor country should use up its natural assets, should use up its oil or whatever, its copper, and pass on wealth to the future, which the future will value much more. But in a rich society like our own, we should be much more careful with nature. So, pragmatic rather than ideological answers. There are two holes in the governance of nature. In the absence of decent governance, nature gets plundered. Because without natural owners, then unnatural owners crowd in. And plunder can take two forms. One is where the few expropriate what should belong to the many. And we've seen that again and again, especially in the poorest societies. So that's a very obvious form of plunder. But the other form of plunder is where the present generation burns up natural assets that should belong equally to the future, but doesn't compensate the future. So these are the two forms of plunder. The few steal from the many, or the present steals from the future. One or both are likely to happen unless you have good rules of governance to protect nature from that form of plunder. So where are these two holes of governance in the world? One is in the poorest countries of the world, the countries I call the bottom billion. And there, most, not all of them, but most of them suffer from rather weak governance. They've got weak governance combined with very valuable natural assets. Natural assets loom very large in these societies. And so there's been a tendency to plunder in one form or another, and often in both forms. The few steal from the many, and they steal from the future. So that's one hole that I'm going to look at. And then the other hole in governance, which is even more extreme, is that an awful lot of natural assets kind of fall between the stools of national governments. Many natural assets don't respect our man-made borders. For example, the fish in the seas, the natural assets beneath the seas, and the natural assets beneath the poles. And essentially, there's no global governance that manages those assets. The bottom billion, or the resources in the bottom billion, now define the present frontier for resource exploitation, for the exploitation of nature. At the moment, we don't have the technology to exploit many of the natural assets that are in international waters and underneath the oceans, underneath the poles. But we'll get that technology. We'll get it quite soon. And so the present frontier is the exploitation in the bottom billion. And we're seeing that, for example, in Africa, we're seeing the second scramble for Africa. The first was colonialism. And what we'll see in a few years will be a scramble for the oceans, underneath the oceans and underneath the poles. In fact, we just got a taste of that last week, where you might have noticed Norway and Russia did a deal. They reached agreement on carving up part of the Arctic. And it was very easy for them to reach agreement because, you know what? They've both plundered what should have belonged to all of us. They've basically both agreed to encroach on what was international territory. And the reason they did that was that they suspect there's huge natural assets beneath the Arctic. So those are the two really low governance areas, the countries of the bottom billion and the international areas. And let me start with the poorest countries, the countries of the bottom billion. Those are the areas where natural assets are more important for these poor societies than anywhere else. Proportionately, natural assets are very much bigger than invested assets in these societies. That's because their invested assets are so small, they're negligible. So natural assets are roughly twice as important as invested assets in the poorest countries. We think of the poorest countries because of that. We think of them as sort of awash with natural assets. We think of Africa as sort of resource abundant. Actually, at the moment, it isn't. I'm going to give you the one number that you'll remember from this talk in a year's time. Let me predict that. And it's the following. We're going to start with looking at the rich world, the countries of the OECD. The rich world accounts for about a quarter of the Earth's land surface. And if we take the average square mile in the rich countries, underneath it, there are about $300,000 of subsoil assets. Okay. And now we're going to move from the rich countries to Africa, another huge area of the world's surface. And we're going to look beneath the average square mile. And I want you to think for a minute, is the figure for Africa, is it less than the $300,000 in the rich countries, or is it more? Almost everybody thinks that it's more because they associate Africa with resource abundance. But actually, the figure for Africa is much less. It's about $60,000, only about a fifth of the rich countries. Now, in one sense, I cheated, because the figures I've given you are for known subsoil assets. I tried to find the figures for unknown subsoil assets, but you know what? I couldn't find them. So very likely, there's at least as much underneath Africa as there is underneath the rich countries of the world. Statistically, it's pretty unlikely that these two huge slices of the world would have very different averages. So let's suppose that underneath Africa is about the same as underneath the rich countries. $60,000 has been found already, and there's another $240,000 to be found. You know, with very high global commodity prices now, over the next decade or two, that $240,000 worth is going to be found. It's going to be found in the scramble for Africa. It's going to be found by hook or by crook. And probably by crook. That's the default option. Because historically, most of Africa's natural resources have been plundered rather than harnessed for prosperity. So the challenge is to make sure that this scramble for Africa Mark II, which is, I think, inevitably going to happen, the challenge is to harness that for prosperity, to make sure that history doesn't repeat itself. And now I'm going to tell you what has to happen to get away from plunder and get to harnessing prosperity. There's a whole chain of decisions that have to be got right. We've already actually looked at the first link in the chain. You won't have noticed, but the first link in the chain is that these resources have to be discovered. And very obviously, something's gone wrong with that link in Africa and the other countries of the bottom billion. That's why so little has been discovered relative to the rich world. So, let's suppose that that problem gets fixed. I think it will be fixed, just because the incentive for discovery is now so big. So let's move on to the next link in the chain, which is, if the resources are coming out of the ground, the next challenge is to capture those revenues for the society rather than for the few. And that depends upon the design of a good tax system that's actually implemented effectively. And to date, that link in the chain has gone disastrously wrong. Let me give you one example. The Democratic Republic of the Congo, right, which incidentally is neither democratic nor a republic. It's only recently been rebranded the Congo, actually, but we'll give it that. Exports of gold from the Congo are believed to be of the order of $1 billion a year. Nobody knows with any accuracy, but that's the estimate. revenues flowing from that gold into the treasury of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, $37,000. So something staggeringly wrong with the capturing of value for the society. The few are plundering the many. Let's go to the third link. And the third link is that the area, the inhabitants of the area where the resources are being extracted have to be properly treated. And at the moment, they're not. I'll give you the example of the Niger Delta, which is now in revolt, has been in revolt for the last few years. And it was provoked into revolt partly by a failure to compensate the local inhabitants for very substantial environmental costs. So what's needed is generous compensation for those costs and equal participation in the benefits. But the benefits shouldn't accrue just to the local inhabitants. If that happens, then we get another form of the few stealing from the many. Just because you happen to live right above some very valuable natural assets, that shouldn't give you a greater claim to ownership than the other citizens in the country. Natural assets should be spread in terms of ownership as widely as possible. And in practical terms, the widest possible means all the citizens of the country, present and future. That's true in North America as well as in Africa. You know, just because some Inuit paddles his kayak several thousand feet over an oil field doesn't, in my mind, mean that he should own the oil field. He should be compensated for any damage incurred in getting the oil out, and he should participate equally as a Canadian or whatever in the benefits. But exclusive ownership rights, no. And the neglect of just and proper compensation to damage provokes people into claiming more than is justified. They claim full ownership. That's what's happened in the Niger Delta. The proper defense against greedy local claims of ownership is full compensation and full participation in benefits that accrue to all the children of the nation. And both of those must be credible and transparent. And of course, in Nigeria, neither of them has been credible or transparent, and that's why local people are angry, because they see all this damage being incurred and no benefits, and the reaction is to say, it's ours, not you thieves. Right? So that's the third link in the chain. Let's suppose we've got all these links in the chain okay. We've discovered the natural assets, we've captured value for the society, and we've compensated the areas of the resource extraction. Now the hard part starts. Because the next link in the chain is what do you do with the money? And the key move here is that you shouldn't plunder the future.
I'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Paul Collier, author of The Plundered Planet.
So, we've managed to fix the first three links in this chain. We've got revenues flowing in, and now the challenge is to save those revenues, at least save enough of them, so that the future is compensated. We've depleting a bunch of natural assets, and we must hand on to the future a bunch of other assets. Typically, that hasn't happened. Take Nigeria, where they've been extracting oil, billions and billions of dollars of it, since 1970. And until 2003, the most generous estimate you can make is that 10% of that oil revenue went into any form of savings, any form of asset. So the future was being plundered. What forms of asset should be acquired? The model that's out there, which countries look to if they actually want to do the right thing, is Norway. 50 developing countries have asked Norway for advice. But unfortunately, Norway's the wrong model. It's actually a disastrous model for developing countries. It's a good model for Norway. What Norway does with its money is it saves the money, and it saves the money in foreign financial assets. And that makes a lot of sense for Norway, because Norway has got so much invested capital in Norway that it's actually got more invested capital per worker than any other country in the world, literally. And that means if you pile on yet more capital in Norway, that capital isn't very productive. It makes more sense for the Norwegians to hold other people's capital, where it'll be more productive. But now turn to Africa, and Africa's at the other end of the spectrum from Norway. Africa and the other countries of the bottom billion are desperately capital scarce. They need that investment in their own societies. And so the Norwegian model, which many countries are fascinated by, is the wrong model for them. And now we come to the final link in the chain, which is the hardest. So we've got the resources out of the ground, we've captured their value for society, we've compensated the local communities where the resources are being extracted, we've saved the money and decided to invest it in our own society. And now the question is, how do we invest productively? Because the reason these countries are so short of capital is usually that they're actually very bad at investing. And so that final link in the chain is building the capacity to invest productively. That's the sort of capacity that the West Coast of America has better than any other society on Earth. But Africa and the other countries of the bottom billion need to build those skills of how to find productive ways of investing. I call that phase investing in investing, building the capacity to invest. So that's the whole decision chain, and it's quite a long and complex decision chain. What's more, it's got to hold the entire chain. It's literally a chain. It's a weakest link problem. If any of the links in that chain break, then you get plunder in one form or another. The society can't drag itself from poverty to prosperity. So there's the chain, and what's really the most difficult thing is that it's not just got to hold once, it's got to hold again and again, at least for a generation, because that's the realistic time scale in which a society can move from being impoverished to being reasonably prosperous. So this whole chain of decisions has got to hold again and again and again. The question is, how can that happen? And I'm going to park that question and now turn to the other hole in governance of natural assets. We'll come back to it, but now we're going to look at that other hole in governance, which is the international assets. There are many such international assets, but I'm going to focus on one particular one, which is quite small, but illustrates all the problems, and that's fish. The fish of the high seas. The fish of the oceans. It's a relatively small industry, so the amount of money involved by the standards of natural assets and natural liabilities is not very big. The entire fishing industry is about $80 billion a year, which is, you know, is serious money, but by the standards of natural assets, this is chicken feed. And fish, it's a blindingly obvious problem that if we eat all the fish, they won't be able to reproduce, and then there'll be no more fish, right, for our grandchildren. So that's, it's a very straightforward problem that the oceans of the world are not policed, and so the default option is plunder. It didn't used to be a problem because in the past the technology of fishing was such that anybody could go and catch a fish. It didn't matter. There were enough fish that that the costs of fishing meant that you never exhausted the fishing stock. And now, as the technology of catching fish has got better and better and better, we've not switched out of the mode in which we thought of fish as abundant to the recognition that fish are scarce. Today's fishermen still think of themselves as having a right to fish because earlier generations of fishermen had that right. They could go and catch fish. And that extrapolation from a past when fish were abundant because there was no technology to catch them to a present and a future where fish are very scarce, it's a very foolish extrapolation. It's based on a deep misunderstanding of the economics of nature. And one of my themes is going to be that we've got to overcome that sort of misunderstanding. So just because the past could catch fish without restriction doesn't mean that the present and future can. That's often an argument used by emerging market economies, that because you did it in the past, we should be able to do it in the future. The same argument is used with carbon emissions. Because America emitted carbon emissions before it was a problem, then China can emit carbon after it is a problem. And that's just a false move. It's exactly analogous to the false move of saying just because in the past a few people were able to fish with a simple technology, everybody should be able to fish in the future with a technology that would exhaust the fish stock. So here's an industry, an $80 billion a year fishing industry. And if we used efficient technology to catch fish, the costs of catching that $80 billion worth of fish would be less than $80 billion. There'd be quite a decent surplus, which economists call rent. The best way to grasp rent is to think of oil. It costs about $7 a barrel to get the typical barrel of oil out of the ground, and it's worth $80. So most of the value of a barrel of oil is rent. It's not a return on risk, it's not a return on capital, it's not a return on effort, work, or anything. It's just rent. It's the intrinsic value of the natural asset. Right? And it's that rent that should belong to as many people as possible, not to the people who get the stuff out the ground. And the same is true with fish. But the figures are less dramatic. They're also less well known, but probably with efficient fishing technology, there'd be about a $20 billion of rent out of that $80 billion of value. So what should be happening is that citizens of the world, in some form or other, should be getting that $20 billion of rent. And you know what? Instead of us getting $20 billion of rent, we're actually paying $30 billion a year in subsidy to the fishing industry. Huh? So instead of it being a source of value to us, it's a source of cost. What is that $30 billion of subsidy used for? Well, it's used to plunder the fish. There's even more plunder than if we didn't have the subsidy. So has that made fishermen rich? No, because what it's produced is a massively inflated fishing fleet. So the subsidies are being dissipated in a very high cost of fishing. We see that most dramatically in America, where, at least within coastal waters, you regulate, but you regulate, to be honest, with amazing inefficiency. Because the way you regulate is to limit very severely the number of days each year that the fishing boats can go out. It's limited often to just 2 or 3 days a year. So you end up with a very large fishing fleet, which is idle nearly all the time, and then for a very short window in the year, everybody rushes out, catches any fish they can find, including what's politely called a bycatch, which is the little fish that should be left, but instead, in the great scramble to catch, they're destroyed. So the present structure of the world fishing industry is really sad. I mean, this is a blindingly obvious problem, that if we go on plundering fish, there'll be none left. Right? By the time it becomes inefficient for us to find the fish, they can't find each other, right? So they can't reproduce. So it's tragic that we can't even manage to control fish properly. How we're going to manage other assets, I dread to think. So we've got these two problems, the problem of plunder of the natural assets of the bottom billion. How can they get this decision chain holding again and again? And the problems of fish and the much more valuable other natural assets and liabilities that are, as it were, international assets and liabilities. What can we do? And my argument is that there's actually no substitute for building a critical mass of informed citizens, society by society. In the countries of the bottom billion, the only way that this decision chain will be got right again and again is if each decision is embedded in understanding by enough citizens that they hold government to account. Is it a forlorn hope to imagine that citizens in these countries can hold government to account? No, it isn't. Let me give you an extraordinary little example in a society which is one of the most repressive on earth, and that's China. Remember that a couple of years ago there were earthquakes in China and schools collapsed and killed school children. And the reason those schools collapsed was that they were very badly built. They were badly built because local government officials had been corrupt. They'd not enforced building regulations. They'd taken bribes. Within 48 hours of that event happening, Chinese citizens managed to find out, using the net, first of all, they found out why these schools had collapsed. Then they found out who in their communities had taken the bribes that had weakened the schools. And then still within 48 hours, they'd managed to organize amongst themselves and come out with street protests against those government officials. There's a wonderful photo on the web of a Chinese local government official on his knees before a crowd of angry parents. Now, I put it to you that if that was possible in China a couple of years ago, in 10 years' time, it'll be much more possible in the much more liberal societies of most of the countries of the bottom billion. And so accountability of government to citizen for this decision chain is possible. The challenge is to build the information, the critical mass of opinion, by lowering the costs of knowledge. That's why I wrote the Plundered Planet, was to try and make these ideas much more readily accessible. In The Bottom Billion, my previous book, I'd floated one idea, which was that the world needed a natural resource charter, a simple statement of what I've just described, the decision chain in harnessing natural assets. Thousands and thousands of people have read The Bottom Billion as a bestseller. And enough people read it and said, this is a good idea, why don't we do it? And so there is now a natural resource charter. It's a website. You could all look at it. It's naturalresourcecharter.org. It's entirely a civil society citizen effort. It's got the former president of Mexico, Ernesto Zedillo, as its head. It's got your local boy, Mike Spence, Nobel laureate in economics, heading the technical group. And it's pitched at different levels. It's pitched for the ordinary citizen, for journalists, for practitioners who've got to implement the some particular decision. And now the challenge is to light the fire of information that gets that out. The same is true of the international natural assets. The approach that we've taken so far as a global community is the old-fashioned approach of hoping that by putting our governments together in the same room or the same conference hall, that they'll do the decent thing and come up with some global agreement. And it doesn't work. It never worked very well, but it works much less well now than it did 10 or 20 years ago. There's much stronger petty nationalisms that governments are displaying than they used to display. And so that approach just doesn't work anymore. So what's the alternative at an international level? It's that we build society by society enough people who see this common ethics of a responsibility towards the future, the preservation of value, the custodianship of value, not literally the preservation of a bunch of natural artifacts, but the custodianship of value. And that sense is common across a lot of different societies. Just let me give you two or three examples of how it's common. You find that concept of custodianship of value deeply rooted in Christian ethics. It's the Christian concept of stewardship. Those of you who are familiar with the parable in St. Luke, the parable of the talents, will recognize that. The rich man leaves talents with his stewards, and the steward who's praised, they're the stewards who've actually invested the talents and multiplied them. The steward who's literally preserved the talents, wrapping them up, is chastised. That preservation of artifacts is not what Christian stewardship is about. And then if we go to the radically different culture of Islam, and we look at the one democratic Islamic society, which is Kuwait, they've, like Norway, they've built a fund for future generations. They've depleted their oil, but they've built up a matching fund of assets for the future. Or if we turn to Africa, which is the societies where I usually work, well, the African governments have failed to do that, but their populations are not cheering them on. They're very critical of what their governments have done. As a Zambian friend of mine said to me, what, when the copper runs out, what are our children going to say of us? Right? And so many radically different cultures recognize this common ethics of custodianship of value. And on the basis of that, society by society, we can build a more responsible attitude towards natural assets and the international assets. So society by society, a critical mass of like-thinking people sharing the same information and drawing the same conclusions can push their governments into common action. So that's the agenda, is to try and build this critical mass of informed opinion. I'm an old guy. I don't know the technology to do that. I can write the books, but I'm dependent on other people reading them, especially young people who actually understand how to light the fires of information. a couple of weeks ago when I gave one of these talks, young woman came up to me afterwards and she said, I suppose it's on YouTube, is it? And I said, I don't know. And she sent me an email the next morning saying, it is now. So that's the sort of reaction I need. We need a lot of people to get up to speed in the issues and then to build this critical mass. Thanks very much indeed.
I'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Paul Collier, author of The Plundered Planet. We will now be taking questions from our audience, and please speak clearly so our radio listeners can hear your questions. Any questions from the audience?
David Lair with Mercy Corps, and we do a lot of work in the countries that you've written about. I'm still a little unclear about how you incent somebody like a China or an India who says, I'm using my resources to deliver what my citizens want, which are basically jobs and stability, and I'm providing the value that my citizens are asking me for, and I can't really worry about the environment in the way that you, Mr. OECD, would like me to, but I'm doing what I think is right, and I'm just still not clear what the counterargument is to that.
Well, of course, sometimes they will be right. As I stressed, the right answer is not always preservation of nature. Sometimes it's quite right and proper for poor societies to harness their nature for other assets. And we in the rich societies shouldn't try and resist that. But where there's a much greater difficulty is with the plunder of international assets and liabilities. Very obviously with carbon. If China and India emit a lot of carbon, then they're inflicting costs, not just on themselves, but on everybody else. Now, how can we avoid that? Partly, it is that Chinese citizens, Indian citizens, they're not blocks of stone. They've got ethics the same as anybody else. And so we've had so far a very dysfunctional discourse on these issues in which it's been national posturing of trying to say, you're to blame, and a carve-up of rights to emissions, which is a sort of disastrous way to go to thinking about carbon. Let me sketch what I think should be the approach for a natural liability, a global natural liability like carbon emissions. Instead of worrying about rights of emissions and who should have them, because like all natural assets and liabilities, there's no good answer to that, it's better to think, what would a world look like which was managing carbon emissions efficiently and fairly? And there's one blindingly obvious thing, which is that if the world was handling carbon emissions efficiently and fairly, it wouldn't be possible for a factory to move from one country to another and skip regulations. Right? So that it wouldn't be possible, you wouldn't have a structure in which the incentives for reducing carbon emissions were stronger in one country than another, because that would be both inefficient and unfair. The country that wasn't doing very much would be profiting at the expense of others. And so the incentive structure, country by country, for carbon emissions would need to look the same pretty well. The incentive structure could be that each country imposes a very similar rate of carbon tax Or it could be that they use a package of regulations which have the equivalent incentive effects to a carbon tax. That can be left to each country, as can the collection of the revenues from carbon taxes. But that's what an efficient and fair world would look like. And it seems to me everybody everywhere can see that that's where we've got to head to. And if we'd had a discourse which started off with that discussion, instead of saying who's guilty, who can have what rights of emissions, because once you go down that road, there's no ethically obvious answer. So part of the answer is build a common ethics. But actually I'm particularly unworried by China and India. And let me tell you why. Here's the paradox. The big problem with anything to do with a global public good or public bad is what's called free riding. And there are only five countries on Earth that are too big to free ride. That is, they're so big that they know if they don't follow the rules, there's no hope of anybody else following the rules. They're deal breakers. And those five countries are you, America, China, India, Europe, if we can manage to get Europe to act as one instead of as 27, and Japan. And those five I think of as the G5. So this is a G5 that are defined structurally as too big to free ride. And so the paradox is that gradually over the next decade or two, they'll realize that they've got a common problem, which is that they've got to play by the rules, otherwise nobody else possibly will. None of the other five will. But even if all five of them play by the rules, their common problem is how to get the others to play by the rules, how to stop free riding amongst the G164 or so. So paradoxically, I'm less worried about China and India than I am about the smaller countries. It'll take us maybe 20 years for the G5 to realize that they are the G5. This tears up history. The historical rivalry between India and China, the rivalry between America and Europe, let alone the much deeper structural rivalry between the poor and the rich. So at the moment, a lot of countries, these G5, are trapped in historical patterns of opposition to each other. But I think going forward, they'll start to realize, no, they have a common problem.
You dealt mostly with resources that are more valuable when they're extracted and processed. What about resources that are more valuable when they are preserved, like forests and things that we actually need to restore environment? And also, one quick question. What's your definition of sustainability?
Yeah, okay. The renewable assets, like forests, the example that I used was fish. Fish are just a good representative example of a renewable asset. And usually with renewable assets, the right thing to do is to renew them. Not always. Not always. My own country, Britain, used to be pretty well completely covered in forest. Thank God, sometime in a few centuries ago, people chopped a lot of the forest down and built cities like London on them. So that tells us preservation is not always the right thing to do. And that leads me into your really good question of what is sustainability. Right? And sustainability is not literally preservation. Right? Sustainability is the preservation of value, not the preservation of literally the same artifacts. Right? And so, of course, as an economy grows and prospers, the structure of the economy changes. Some things drop away and become unimportant, and other assets are built up. So sustainability is fundamentally about values, value, rather than about preserving artifacts. That's true, most obviously, of timber, that it's not always sensible to preserve all the world's forests.
You had mentioned a lot about government regulations and so forth related to carbon, reducing carbon. Well, last summer, Walmart came out with an initiative to have all its suppliers to go in and actually calculate their carbon and be able to report that to Walmart. What are your thoughts about that from a consumer's perspective? Because the idea behind that is the consumer is going to be able to know what whatever they buy is going to have a carbon kind of label to it. Do you see, what are your thoughts about that approach?
Well, I think carbon's an example of where we're all involved, and so it's sensible that we should all get up to speed with information. But we really do need to be well informed. Let me give you an example of the campaign that's called Food Miles. And food miles are targeted against flying food around the world. A lot of Africa grows food which is exported by air to Europe. And there's a lot of hostility to that on the grounds that it must emit a lot of carbon. Actually, it doesn't. It's far more efficient to grow food in a hot climate and fly it to a cold climate than it is to try and grow that food in a cold climate. The actual carbon emitted in the flying process is tiny. It's about 1%. So growing in an environment where people are not consuming very much, wages are much lower, so they're emitting less carbon because they're consuming less. The climate is more favorable to growing the crop, so you don't need to put a lot of energy into it. So the Food Miles campaign, although it uses the language of environmental efficiency, it's actually misguided. And so to counter that, indeed you need a lot of good quantitative information. We need truly informed consumers, not consumers who are just reacting with passion to a little bit of ill-assimilated information.
The structure for a correction that you lay out here sounds great, but it's also one that sounds like it has a very long time schedule to it. You say 20 years for the G5 to get their act in shape. How much longer for the bottom billion? And do we have that sort of time? Now, I'm an economist like you, but I hear a lot of very, dramatic things coming out of some environments about just how long we have to reverse some of these problems. Is yours going to be fast enough? Is yours going to be fast enough to handle just a swelling of the under 20 population in many of these third world countries where there is no economic viability and the politics that could create? So it's a matter of dynamics of time. Could you comment some on that?
Yes. And what you say is quite right, that we need a sense of urgency about this. I'm moderately hopeful, and the reason I'm hopeful is actually what you said, that there's a burgeoning of youth, both in our own societies and in the societies of the bottom billion, youth is much more aware of these issues. In our own societies, environmental issues are really now being absorbed by young people much, much more dramatically than amongst the general population. In the societies of the bottom billion, young people are really angry with the mistakes that their elders have made, and they're very well connected to information and able to coordinate with each other. You know, that the society in the world that's most advanced in mobile phone technology is not California, it's Kenya. You know, Google actually sent a team to Kenya to learn. And so the combination of radio, there's now a lot of radio in Africa, very competitive radio market. The combination of radio and texting, that's going to be the technology which builds a critical mass of informed youth. Youth in the past in Africa has been mobilized by the elderly for dreadful things, for violent ethnic violence. And in the future, I think it's going to be mobilized in a very different way. One of my dear friends is Jongi Thongo, who's been going around rural Kenya for the last few months. He's a techno geek, if ever there was one, and what he's trying to do is build social movements across youth that cross-cut the ethnic divides and focus on countering the many forms of plunder that Kenyan society has suffered from. So it is possible for societies to turn on a dime. Let me give you the example of Nigeria, which turned on a dime. For years, from 1970, when Nigeria discovered oil, until 2003, that oil was plundered. And then in 2003, there was a social revolution, and reformers came in, and the reformers slammed up the savings rate from next to nothing to a very high savings rate, just in time for the last oil boom. And so within 4 years, they'd gone from Nigeria having $30 billion of debt to it having $70 billion of foreign exchange reserves, with all the debt paid off. That was a transformation, and it happened fast. Now, Nigeria wobbled in the last couple of years, but last week I met the guy who's just become the new finance minister. Great guy, and his first question to me was, are we saving enough? And so societies really can learn from past mistakes. There's a burning sense amongst a lot of Nigerians that they're not going to repeat the mistakes of the past. Yeah? I mean, that's happened. The society in Europe that is best defended against inflation is Germany. And it's best defended against inflation because they had the worst inflation.
Hi. So you talked about technology and how we don't have the advanced technology yet to help the assets. And you talked about the G5s, the countries, how we're, you know, we should stop free riding. But also, what kind of technology do you see now, or do you see we should have in the future that could help?
Well, the technology that I think is there are two technologies coming down the line, right? One is the technology of resource extraction. Within 20 years, I think we'll be able to take natural resources out of the ocean, beneath the oceans, and beneath the Arctic and the Antarctic. And that's both good news and bad, right? Potentially, it's great that we can get all these natural assets, but it's very bad news if the technical capacity to exploit nature runs ahead of the governance capacity to make sure that that exploitation doesn't turn into plunder. Right? So that's one form of technology. Then the other form of technology, which is the big hope, is the information technology that has lowered the costs of truth, effectively. We don't have to live in ignorance anymore. My fear is that because nature is such an emotive topic, you know, it's got moralized before it's got analyzed. People feel passionate about it, but they don't understand the science and the economics underlying it. And so my big fear is that we'll have ignorant passion. If you like, environment is becoming the new religion, but we know from history that religion without understanding can be a very dangerous thing. And so that's my fear. And to counter that, citizens have just got to get up to speed with the real issues, with the science and the economics of nature. That's why I wrote the book.
Our thanks again to Professor Paul Collier for his insightful remarks here and for all the great work he's doing to inform us about our own future. We also thank our audience here, as well as our radio audience, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 104th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.